Nehemiah chapters 5 through 7, the sixth talk in a series on Ezra and Nehemiah, was presented by Gil Greco on August 30, 2020, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gil Greco. This recording is being made available to you by Gutenberg College, a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. This recording was taken from a talk originally streamed online. Ezra Nehemiah, handout number 4, accompanies this talk.
Welcome to Online Reformation Fellowship. I'm Gil Greco. We have been going through a series on Ezra Nehemiah, which I have been contending is a single book. I asked Robbie to label this section of Ezra Nehemiah. This section is really Ezra's memoirs, and I asked her to label it complications. So far in Ezra Nehemiah, we've seen three of what I contend are five sections to the book. I've been saying that the structure of Ezra Nehemiah can roughly be construed as A, B, A, B, C. So the A sections are parallel to each other, the B sections are parallel to each other, and then C is a concluding section which wraps up the whole book. My intent in laying out this structure is to give a general overview of what the work is doing, not to be exact to the nth detail. So today we're going to start to see the B section of Nehemiah. One of the complications in this section is, unlike Ezra, where you have everything going swimmingly until chapter 8, and then you sort of transition into chagrin until the anticlimax of chapter 10, we're going to sort of go back and forth in Nehemiah between positivity and chagrin. There's going to be several incidents that come up here where it becomes clear that everything is not great in Jerusalem, and then people are going to repent, and then we're going to have something else come up to show that everything's not great in Jerusalem, and then people are going to repent. So I'm still going to talk in terms of A, B, A, B, C, because before this point in the narrative in Nehemiah, everything that's been happening has shown how God is taking care of the Jews in allowing Nehemiah to come with money to help rebuild the wall. Even though there's opposition, they're sort of able to face into that opposition and deal with stuff. But from this point forward, the essential thing that characterizes what I've called the B section is that we're going to see that the Jews are still rebellious, despite this care that God's been giving them. As I said, we're going to see them sort of waffle back and forth. And I'm sure that you could create an outline that was more precise and sort of showing the circles or the cycles or the chiasms, however you want to do that. But I think my broad outline is accurate, and we're going to begin to see the shift into what I've called the B section of Nehemiah. Also today, we are going to get into the returnees list, and we will do our best to make that not terribly boring listening. However, you will be greatly helped if you have the handout to look at as I'm going through this section. Okay, we're going to start in paragraph 70, which in your real Bibles is Nehemiah 5, 1 through 5. I'm going to go ahead and read that. Now, there was a great outcry of the people and their wives against their Jewish brothers, for there were those who said, "We, our sons and our daughters, are many. Therefore, let us get grain that we may eat and live." There were others who said, "We are mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, and our houses that we might get grain because of the famine." Also, there were those who said, "We have borrowed money for the king's tax on our fields and our vineyards. Now our flesh is like the flesh of our brothers, our children like their children. Yet behold, we are forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves, and some of our daughters are forced into bondage already, and we are helpless because our fields and vineyards belong to others. Okay. So let me remind you a little bit of the situation that we've been in that's sort of leading into this section. Nehemiah, as you recall, asked King Artaxerxes to be able to come back to Jerusalem and rebuild the wall. We saw the beginning of that reconstruction. And part of the problem with the reconstruction is that the neighbors of Jerusalem, of Judah, were not happy that they were doing this. And they're characterized, the sort of stand-ins for the whole of their neighbors are Sanballat, who we know was the governor of Samaria, a guy named Tobiah, who I argued last week was probably Jewish because Tobiah is made up of the Hebrew words for good and Yahweh. So his name means something like Yahweh is good. So he's probably Jewish, although he is introduced as Tobiah the Ammonite, which could mean that he's from Ammon, although my understanding is that's unlikely given the state of nations around at the time. So more likely what they're saying of him is that he is an Ammonite in the sense that he is not a good Jew, that he is true Ammon as opposed to true Israel. And then occasionally we get Geshem listed, who is an Arab. So those three guys, they hang out with other nobles and folks around them, and in the section we read last week, they made taunts about rebuilding the wall and so forth. And every time that some step is made in the direction of building the wall, Sanballat and Tobiah, at a minimum, and then sometimes Geshem, they get angry and they either use propaganda or they make plans to somehow frustrate the plans of the Israelites. So in one of these instances, what happened was they at least spread a rumor that they were going to attack Jerusalem in force. And in response, Nehemiah had gotten all of the people of Israel to get together and house themselves in Jerusalem so that they had a fighting force so that if Jerusalem was attacked, they could go to all of the places where the wall was weakest and fight off the attackers. The effect of this was it apparently it was never the intention of the attackers to actually attack, or they realized when Nehemiah meant business by putting together some kind of fighting force that they weren't actually interested in attacking Jerusalem. So they left off from attacking Jerusalem if they had ever planned to do that in the first place. But one of the consequences of that is that everyone was just living in Jerusalem as a sort of fortress, even though it was incomplete. But they were all hanging out there so that they could be ready to fight any enemies if they needed to. This means that if you are a farmer who is sort of living near Jerusalem, but your regular sort of house isn't in Jerusalem, that you didn't have time to sort of attend to your crops, attend to your vineyards and your, you know, your olive trees or whatever. So some complaints arise because of this situation. So in this section, we have three complaints listed. It says, "We, our sons and our daughters are many. Let us get grain that we may eat and live." So their first complaint is, "We have a lot of mouths to feed." They say, "We are mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, and our houses that we might get grain because of the famine." They are needing to mortgage their property in order to pay for food because they're not spending time cultivating that land because they're too busy being a part of this militia that Nehemiah has formed in order to defend Jerusalem. And then it says, "We have borrowed money for the king's tax on our fields and our vineyards." Now our flesh is like the flesh of our brothers, our children like their children. Yet behold, we are forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves, and some of our daughters are forced into bondage already, and we are helpless because our fields and vineyards belong to others. So this third group of people, apparently, they are maxed out. They have borrowed money for the king's tax on their field and vineyards. So they've maxed out on the value of their property. And so now they are needing to pay for more food, presumably. And so what has happened is, in order for them to pay for more food, they have either given their children or their children have been taken from them as collateral from their Jewish brethren. We're going to find out in just a minute, in order for them to be able to pay for food. So it seems we have these three complaints, and each of the complaints, each person is in sort of a more dire situation, it would seem to me. The first group, they have a lot of mouths to feed. However, they still have the resources to do that. Maybe not enough to be comfortable elsewhere, but it's very taxing for them to be able to feed everybody, but they're managing to do that. The second group is having to offer their property as collateral in order to be able to afford food. And the third group has run out of property as a means of collateral to pay for food. And so now, as their children have been taken as collateral so that they can afford food. So we have these three groups of people who are being put upon by this situation. And it seems that the people who are lending the money are their Jewish neighbors. So here's Nehemiah's reaction. This is 5, 6 through 13. Then I was very angry when I had heard their outcry and these words. I consulted with myself and contended with the nobles and the rulers and said to them, "You are exacting usury, each from his brother." Therefore, I held a great assembly against them. I said to them, "We, according to our ability, have redeemed our Jewish brothers who were sold to the nations. Now would you even sell your brothers that may be sold to us?" Then they were silent and could not find a word to say. Again, I said, "The thing which you are doing is not good. Should you not walk in the fear of our God because of the reproach of the nations, our enemies? And likewise, I, my brothers and my servants are lending them money and grain. Please, let us leave off this usury. Please give back to them this very day their fields, their vineyards, their olive groves, and their houses, also the hundredth part of the money and of the grain, the new wine and the oil that you are exacting from them." Then they said, "We will give it back and will require nothing from them. We will do exactly as you say." So I called the priests and took an oath from them that they would do according to this promise. I also shook out the front of my garment and said, "Thus may God shake out every man from his house and from his possessions who does not fulfill this promise. Even thus may he be shaken out and emptied." And all the assembly said, "Amen," and they praised the Lord. Then the people did according to this promise. Okay, so Nehemiah's response to this outcry by these different groups is that he's angry. He accuses the rich and powerful of usury. Usury is prohibited in the Torah. Basically, usury is the practice of lending money at interest so that the person who pays back has to pay back more money than they originally borrowed. Then it says, "We, according to our ability, have redeemed our Jewish brothers who were sold to the nations. Now would you even sell your brothers that may be sold to us?" This is very stilted in the NASB. Looking at different commentators and sort of seeing what the underlying sense of what's going on here, I think it would be better to render it something like this. And I think you can almost see this in the NASB. It's almost like the NASB has translated something that they're not sure what it means. But okay, so here we have, "We were able to redeem our Jewish brothers who were sold to foreign nations. But you might as well have sold them out as far as we are concerned." Okay, so when he says, "Now would you even sell your brothers that they may be sold to us?" What he's saying is, so there's this sort of contradiction in what's going on. All of us together, we've been able to bring exiles back to Jerusalem. But now what you're doing is you're selling your brothers, right? You are taking the children of the people who owe you money and selling them as slaves. And for all we care, for all that matters to us, that they be sold to us, not in the sense that we are buying them, but in the sense that in our consideration, in our estimation, you might as well have sold them out as far as we are concerned. So there's this contradiction. We're trying to get people back into Israel because they're in exile, and now you're just selling them off as far as we're concerned. So I think the idea is they're not actually selling the children off to foreign nations. They're keeping it within Israel, but Nehemiah is saying, as far as we're concerned, right, as far as I care, you've basically sold them out again. If you're going to keep these people, in a state of debt slavery, it's just as bad as if they were still exiled. I think that's the sense of what he's saying. Then Nehemiah notes that he has made loans as well. So presumably he is not lending it out in interest. It does, in the NASB, it does say, please let us leave off this usury. But I think the sense of what's going on here is he was really loaning them things and expecting to get paid back. So Nehemiah is recognizing that he is not making it any easier for anybody by requiring people to pay a loan back, because they have that obligation still on their heads. Although it would seem that he's not going as far as these people who are, you know, collecting by having the children of their neighbors be debt slaves. But what he's advocating, what he's saying when he says, let us leave off this usury, what he's saying is, let's totally forgive all of the loans. So then he says, please give back to them this very day their fields, their vineyards, their olive groves, and their houses, also the 100th part of the money and of the grain, the new wine and oil that you are exacting from them. So he wants them to give back everything. Presumably, this also includes the children who are in debt slavery. To begin with, it is possible that this whole idea of the debt slavery, well, no, I was going to say that it's an exaggeration, but it's one of the complaints that are leveled. So presumably, in not needing to pay back any debts, there would no longer be a need to have the children be debt slaves, and so they would be returned as well, even though Nehemiah doesn't specify in this list what he includes. So he says, give them back their stuff and also all of the fractions, right? All of the interest. I think that's what it means by the 100th part. Give them back all the interest that you were asking of them. Then they said, we will give it back and we'll require nothing from them. We will do exactly as you say. So they agree that they are going to forgive all of these loans. And then Nehemiah calls for the priests. Now, the NASB makes it sound like the priests are the main perpetrators. It does say that he calls the nobles and rulers, and the priests are certainly a part of that sort of upper class of Israel. And the grammar of the sentence is somewhat ambiguous, the commentators tell me. However, the grammar would allow for the priests to just be witnesses to the oaths that the nobles and rulers are swearing. So that first sentence, so I called the priests and took an oath from them. The antecedent might not be priests. It might be these other nobles and rulers. It would not surprise me if it were the priests, because in Malachi, for instance, the priests are not blameless. We already saw earlier in Ezra that the priests were guilty of the mixed marriages, just like a lot of other groups in Israel. So it's not like the priests are faultless. It's just not absolutely clear from the syntax here that it's the priests who are the main people sort of ripping people off. Okay, and then Nehemiah acts out this prayer, right? He shakes out of his garment. Apparently they would carry stuff around in their sleeves. It's sort of where your pockets would be. So you walk around and instead of having pockets on the side of your pants, you have it in your sleeves. So he shakes out his garment and presumably all his loose change and keys and whatever falls out. And he says, "Thus may God shake out every man from his house and from his possessions who does not fulfill his promise." So it's very apparent what he's sort of saying here. Like, I hope if you break your promise that God will shake you out. Like, he's holding you, sort of protecting you, keeping you close to him. If you go back on your promise, I hope he shakes you out of his garment. So, and this idea of shaking the garment, that appears later in the New Testament. The apostles do that on occasion. So it's just demonstrative of, you know, if you break the promise, the you are going to be discarded, just in the same way that, you know, here Nehemiah's shaking out his loose change and so on. And then it seems everything goes well. All the assembly says, "Amen," or "May it be so," and they praise the Lord, and the people did according to this promise. So everyone's keeping their word for now. Okay. 5:14-19. "Moreover, from the day that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year to the 32nd year of King Artaxerxes, for 12 years, neither I nor my kinsmen have eaten the governor's food allowance." Okay, so apparently this food allowance is some kind of tax that the governor is entitled to, and presumably he would use that tax to pay for all of the food he would be eating. "But the former governors who were before me laid burdens on the people and took from them bread and wine, besides 40 shekels of silver. Even their servants domineered the people, but I did not do so because of the fear of God." So apparently the form of the tax is not in money. It's in actual foodstuffs, bread and wine. It could be that bread and wine are standing in there for sort of the general category of food. Nehemiah later is going to talk about all the food that he needed to feed to people. Presumably, if the governor has a food allowance, he could demand more than just specifically food and wine. The point is that, and you'll notice that these governors also have 40 shekels of silver. Presumably, that's for, you know, delicacies or whatever that people aren't going to produce on their home farm. But Nehemiah did not do this because he had the fear of God, is what he says. So there is a kind of advantage that governors took of the people of Israel, and that the nobles and rulers were taking of the people in the previous section, that Nehemiah is very careful not to take of them when he is governor. He says, "I also applied myself to the work on this wall. We did not buy any land, and all my servants were gathered there for the work." So presumably a lot of governors, what they would do when they became governor is they would work on sort of, you know, money ventures. They buy up property. Possibly they have, you know, rent and people are paying for it and working on it. And this is an investment, and it's sort of a perk of being governor is you can also sort of make money on this sort of side venture. But Nehemiah is noting that he did not do that. What he did instead is he applied himself to the work on this wall. The purpose of him asking King Artaxerxes for him to come to Jerusalem and do what he's doing is so that he could complete the wall, not so that he could do some other kind of venture. "Moreover, there were at my table 150 Jews and officials, besides those who came to us from the nations that were around us. Now that which was prepared for each day was one ox and six choice sheep. Also birds were prepared for me, and once in 10 days all sorts of wine were furnished in abundance. Yet for all this I did not demand the governor's food allowance, because the servitude was heavy on this people." So not only did he not take money from the people, presumably he also fed people out of his own expense. And he just lists what this expense was, right? An ox and six choice sheep, birds, and then wine. And so he is interested in taking care of the folks around him, of making sure that the officials, presumably the sort of upper crust, who he needs to sort of deal with as part of his role as governor, he makes sure that they are given choice food. But he is not doing that by burdening the less well-off in the society. And he ends the section by saying, "Remember me, O my God, for good. according to all that I have done for this people. This is not the last time he's going to ask this same thing of God, that God remember him because of what he's done for the people. And notice that this section that we just read, 14 through 19, like in Ezra 4, Nehemiah is jumping forward sort of to a summary of the 12 years of as governor. Even though the wall is completed in the first year of him as governor, and we're going to get a little bit more information about that in the coming sections, he just feels free to be able to jump forward 12 years, summarize how he spent money or didn't spend money in those 12 years, and then just jump back into the narrative in the following section. Okay, so the next section. Now, when it was reported to Sanballat, Tobiah, to Geshem the Arab, and to the rest of our enemies that I had rebuilt the wall, and that no breach remained in it, although at that time I had not set up the doors and the gates, then Sanballat and Geshem sent a message to me saying, "Come, let us meet together at Kepharim in the plain of Ono." But they were planning to harm me. So I sent messengers to them saying, "I am doing a great work and I cannot come down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and come down to you?" They sent messages to me 4 times in this manner, and I answered them in the same way. Then Sanballat sent his servant to me in the same manner a 5th time with an open letter in his hand. In it was written, and presumably this is him copying the letter, "It is reported among the nations, and Geshem says, that you and the Jews are planning to rebel. Therefore, you are rebuilding the wall. And you are to be their king, according to these reports. You have also appointed prophets to proclaim in Jerusalem concerning you, 'A king is in Judah.' And now it will be reported to the king according to these reports. So come now, let us take counsel together." Then I sent a message to him saying, and presumably this is the note that he scribbled back, "Such thing as you are saying have not been done, but you are inventing them in your own mind." For all of them were trying to frighten us, thinking they will become discouraged with the work and it will not be done. But now, O God, strengthen my hands. Okay, so just as they are about to complete the wall, Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem want to set up a conference with Nehemiah. Now, let me back up a little bit. In Nehemiah 3, we get told of these different people who are working on the wall, who build, it says they rebuilt its doors and its bars and so on. So presumably what we have in Nehemiah 3, because we're told in this section that the doors were not hung. They'd set everything up, but he'd not set up the doors and the gates. So presumably what we're being told in the account in Nehemiah 3 is not what happened, you know, on that day, but it's more of a topographical account of how the walls were rebuilt rather than a chronological account of how it was rebuilt. They may have built, you know, the frames of the doors and then built the walls connecting the frames of the doors. And it was only after all of that was done, because it's easier to defend sort of the doorway than it would be sort of a wall that you have to climb over. Presumably then is when they put the doors back in place. So I don't think that there is a contradiction here between Nehemiah 3 and this passage. It's just in the Nehemiah 3 passage, he wasn't telling us sort of a play-by-play of what happened. Rather, he was saying, and this guy was ultimately responsible for putting this door in place and building this much wall. Maybe he's not meaning to clarify, but it becomes clear to us if we're paying attention that the doors were one of the last things to be put on. So they're about to finish the wall is the important thing. And Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem send messengers and say, "Let's meet together at Kepharim in the plain of Ono." Now, it doesn't say why they do this. The text does not give us much hint of what's going on. Maybe the fact that they send a messenger means that there's some kind of urgency to it, but I have a hard time piecing together why Nehemiah would be like, "Oh yeah, I need to go to Kepharim in the plain of Ono." Maybe Sanballat and Geshem have an army, and they, what they're saying is, let's parlay, let's try to come to some kind of agreement about something. In any case, Nehemiah recognizes that they're planning to harm him. And he says, I'm really busy, so I'm not going to stop working so that I can come down and talk to you guys. And apparently they send him four messengers who say the same thing. So that having not worked, Sanballat and Geshem send him a letter. And this letter is written out, I think. We have a copy of the letter here. It says, it is reported among the nations, and Gashmu says, that you and the Jews are planning to rebel. Therefore, you are rebuilding the wall. So we've seen this before. We've seen the rumor mongering. I believe we've even seen it from Sanballat and Tobiah. And we also saw that in the letter that Rehum and Shimshai sent to Artaxerxes back all the way back in Ezra 4, that the thing they were saying is, look, king, these people are rebels and you need to stop them or they're going to do bad stuff. And the king had, his response was, well, I mean, yeah, they're rebellious, but it's not like they can't be brought to heel. So go ahead and stop them. And then they just used that as an excuse to go and attack the Jews as they saw fit. So the same sort of rumor mongering has worked in the past. And here we have Sanballat trying the same sort of thing. He says, it is reported among the nation, and Gashmu says, apparently Gashmu is the same name as Geshem. Gashmu is apparently the sort of alliterated spelling, and Geshem is more of an anachronistic Hebrew rendering of that name. So presumably what has happened in this account and the reason why he says Geshem, why Nehemiah uses Geshem as he's writing his diary and Gashmu in this letter, is because when Sanballat wrote the letter, he used Gashmu, which was the correct, sort of his correct name. But Nehemiah in his diary feels it's fine to change people's names into Hebrew versions of them. So he just calls the same guy Geshem, who's Geshem the Arab. He just calls him Geshem whenever he runs into his name, because that's what he called him in Hebrew. You are to be their king, according to these reports, they say. You have also appointed prophets to proclaim there's a king in Judah. So we're going to tell. We're going to tell the king. So come talk to us, and we're going to tell. That's the tenor of this letter. And then Nehemiah's response is just, it's very funny. He says, you're making this up. You are inventing them in your own mind. So he just doesn't buy it. He doesn't take the bait. And he just responds very matter-of-factly, you're making things up. Presumably, Nehemiah has the kind of relationship with Artaxerxes that we've already talked about in the past, that if someone were to sort of spread this rumor to Artaxerxes, Artaxerxes wouldn't buy it. So Nehemiah has the security of his relationship with Artaxerxes and the fact that he knows that all of this is made up to sort of back him up as he's responding to them. Now, the real reason they were doing this is because they wanted to discourage everybody, get Nehemiah discouraged, or get Nehemiah to leave off working and get everybody to sort of stop work on the wall. So the NESB would have us believe that we then have Nehemiah's prayer, an aside, that's a prayer, asking for God to strengthen his hands. However, O God is apparently not in the original manuscripts. This is something that the NESB has added, presumably because they think it's implied. They think it's a prayer, so it's implied by what's said in the text. Fensham, who's one of the commentators I read, suggests that it should be something like, it strengthened my hands. So if you ignore the NSB for a second, you don't have the God in there. It says, but now it strengthened my hands. So his idea is that the attempts that Sanballat and Geshem are making to discourage Nehemiah strengthen his hands, either because he recognizes that they're so desperate that they will try old tricks. And so that heartens him, or he has this sort of combative reaction to what they're doing, and he's going to show them by building the wall despite everything they're going to do. So in either case, their intent was to discourage Nehemiah and the people working with Nehemiah, but what ended up happening is that Nehemiah was more resolved to finish the wall for one reason or another. Okay, 6:10 through 14. When I entered the house of Shemaiah the son of Deliah, son of Mehetabel, who was confined at home, he said, "Let us meet together in the house of God within the temple, and let us close the doors of the temple, for they are coming to kill you, and they are coming to kill you at night." But I said, "Should a man like me flee, and could one such as I go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in." Then I perceived that surely God had not sent him, but he uttered his prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. He was hired for this reason, that I might become frightened and act accordingly and sin, so that they might have an evil report in order that they could reproach me. Remember, O my God, Tobiah and Sanballat, according to these works of theirs, and also Noadiah the prophetess and the rest of the prophets who were trying to frighten me. Okay, so there is another plot by this guy named Shemaiah, the son of Deliah. And I think if we sort of step back and sort of look at the plot, it works something like this. Shemaiah goes off into Arabia or Samaria, wherever he's going. Nehemiah says he uttered his prophecy. So prophets are, a job that you can have in the ancient Near East, like accountants or lawyers. You have prophets sitting around, and apparently we're going to find out that there are a bunch of prophets who are doing this. But Shemaiah is apparently a prophet, and he is confined to his house. The way that I put this together is he goes off to Samaria and Arabia. He comes back. He's acting very shaken, and he goes into his house and shuts the door. And people are trying to get him to come out. It's very inconvenient because he's not doing his bit and rebuilding the wall or whatever. And so Nehemiah goes to check on him, and Shemaiah's gambit is to argue that the only place that is safe is the temple, because the rest of the wall, is not built. The enemies of Judah are going to sneak in and kill Nehemiah at night. Here's one of those places where the nature of biblical narrative might be helped by more details. This feels very abrupt. But if you sit a bit, you could imagine how Shemaiah could have this whole conversation with Nehemiah where he's slowly building to, what we have to do is we have to go and hide in the temple. It's the only place that's safe. Because the way that Nehemiah reacts to this is he thinks through the implications of what Shemaiah is counseling him to do. And that's how he comes to the realization that what Shemaiah is saying is not from God, but from Tobiah and Sanballat. It's not immediately apparent, it would seem, to Nehemiah that Shemaiah is just spouting nonsense. He has to sort of work through what he is saying would mean in order for him to perceive that God had not sent him. And this is what he works through. He says, "Should a man like me flee, and could one such as I go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in." So, first of all, Nehemiah, so Hebrew is very funny in the way, in some of the ways that it puts together constructions. To say he is mighty like a mighty man is something that comes up in the Psalms occasionally. And, well, I don't know. There's not a lot of comparing because it's sort of just what it is. And you can see sort of this parallelism. Apparently, Shemaiah has some parallelism, some poetry in what he's saying. He says, "For they are coming to kill you, and they are coming to kill you at night." So the parallel of "they are coming to kill you" is "they are coming to kill you at night." So what Nehemiah is saying is, should a man like me flee, is basically saying, you know, should someone who is like me flee? That is, should I flee? So there's a very strange sort of thing here. Some commentators have spoken to the idea that, you know, he's a governor, he's an important person. But I just think what he's saying is, should anybody flee? Is it the place of anyone who is responsible to flee from what's happening? So it's a very sort of funny, unusual Hebrew way of expressing this idea. And then he says, and could one such as I go into the temple to save his life? Fenjam points out that it's probable that Nehemiah is a eunuch, and he's also a layman. And so both of those things go towards Nehemiah not being allowed to be sort of in the inner part of the temple that Shemaiah is suggesting they go into. So if he went into the temple, he may very well be killed by the priests. And he recognizes that even if that isn't the case, because the priests aren't fulfilling what they need to be doing, that at the very least, Tobiah and Sanballat are going to have a way to reproach him. They're going to point to his fearfulness and reproach him that way. And the fact that he's afraid would be an indication to the rest of the community that they also need to be afraid, and that would presumably lead to the walls stop being built. And then we get this, you know, he has this prayer where he says, remember what all these people have done, which includes Noadiah the prophetess and the rest of the prophets who are trying to frighten me. So apparently it's not only Shemaiah, the son of Deliah. It's also this lady Noadiah and other people. So Sanballat and Tobiah hire a bunch of prophets to make prophecies that are supposed to frighten Nehemiah into coming to heal. But he does not. Okay, 6:15 and 16. So the wall was completed on the 25th of the month of Elul in 52 days. When all our enemies heard of it and all the nations surrounding us saw it, they lost their confidence, for they recognized that this work had been accomplished with the help of our God. So here we have the actual record of the completion of the wall. Before, we had a sort of, eventually this guy is going to be responsible for building this section. But now we actually have a record of the date that it was completed, and it took them 52 days from when they started the project to when they finished the project. And we have a very positive note here. For they recognized that this work had been accomplished with the help of our God. The enemies are dissuaded from attacking, from sort of looking at them in reproach, which has been the thing that Nehemiah has been concerned with all along. They recognize that God has worked here because they finished this work, which seemed to have such insurmountable odds to begin with. Okay, 17 through 19. Also in those days, many letters went from the nobles of Judah to Tobiah, and Tobiah's letters came to them. For many in Judah were bound by oath to him because he was the son-in-law of Shechaniah, the son of Arah. And his son Jehohanan had married the daughter of Meshullam, the son of Berechiah. Moreover, they were speaking about his good deeds in my presence and reported my words to him. Then Tobiah sent letters to frighten me. So we have a record of Tobiah and folks in Jerusalem sending letters back and forth. As I had mentioned before last week, Tobiah is clearly connected to folks in Jerusalem. Now we get very specific note of who he's connected to. Before I talk about that, remember that Tobiah is introduced as Tobiah the Ammonite. Now, this passage does not clear up for us whether he is ethnically an Ammonite, whatever that would mean in terms of history. Apparently, Ammon is not a region that one could be from, but you could have some kind of anachronism. He's from the group of people who are in the place that Amon used to be in. So I still feel that ultimately the labeling him an Ammonite has to do with his religious and moral status rather than his ethnic status. But this section does not clarify that for us one way or the other. It may be that he's not ethnically Jewish, even though he has a Jewish name, but this section doesn't help us. What we do see is that he's related to these important people. He is the son-in-law of Shechaniah, the son of Arah. We don't know anything else about Shechaniah, the son of Arah. We know that the sons of Arah are one of the groups of people listed in the returnees from Persia in Ezra 2 and Nehemiah 7. So he's kind of one of the people in one of the main families. He is also, his son is married to Meshulam's daughter. Now, if you remember to last week, we talked about Meshulam, the son of Berechiah. Meshulam, the son of Berechiah, has two spots of the wall that he repairs, and he is listed next to our buddy, Meremoth, the son of Uriah, the son of Hakoz. So if you remember, the sons of Hakoz, I had mentioned, they were one of the groups that didn't have authentication to whether they were priests or not. And then Meremoth is the guy that they weigh the gold and silver into his hands. So last week I argued that Meshulam is probably a priest because the other folks listed in that paragraph are priests. So Meshulam is a well-to-do guy, and he seems to be an upstanding citizen. It's like I was going to say like Dale Carnegie, but some people don't like him. So if you had a similar sort of figure who's, you know, he's invested the community, he's working on sort of, you know, the project at hand. And so if the generation of Jeshua and Zerubbabel is like the founding fathers, then Meshulam is something like a Carnegie or a somebody like that. Abraham Lincoln feels too important to sort of, he's a later generation, but he's one of these sort of bigger figures. And he is in-laws with this guy, Tobiah. But it says that he was speaking about his good, so all the people that Tobiah is related to, including Meshulam, were speaking about his good deeds in my presence and reported my words to him. Then Tobiah sent letters to frighten me. So the NASB is a little bit stilted here. Fensham has, his translation reads, they even mentioned his good deeds to me, and they reported back to him what I had said, but Tobiah sent letters to frighten me. So there's this contrast. They were saying that he's not that bad of a guy. They were telling me all of his good qualities, and I was listening, and I wanted to talk to him, but Tobiah sent letters to frighten me. So you can just imagine the sort of tenor of this sort of great figure in the community, Meshulam, the son of Berechiah, responsible for building two different sections of wall, a well-respected priest, right? And then he has this in-law who's Tobiah, and probably at family functions, you know, Tobiah is not an awful person. And so Meshulam is saying he's not that bad of a guy. And Tobiah's response to Nehemiah is trying to frighten me. He's not interested in being positive towards Nehemiah, even though it seems like his relationship with Meshulam would not lead Meshulam to think that he's just a monster. Okay, 7:1-5. Now, when the wall was rebuilt and I had set up the doors, and the gatekeepers and the singers and the Levites were appointed, then I put Hanani my brother and Hananiah the commander of the fortress in charge of Jerusalem, for he was a faithful man and feared God more than many. Then I said to them, do not let the gates of Jerusalem be opened until the sun is hot, and while they are standing guard, let them shut and bolt the doors. Also appoint guards from the inhabitants of Jerusalem, each at his post, and each in front of his own house. Now the city was large and spacious, but the people in it were few, and the houses were not built. Then my God put it into my heart to assemble the nobles, the officials, and the people to be enrolled by genealogies. So now that everything is rebuilt, Nehemiah has his brother Hanani, who we saw is the person who he was talking to where he originally found out the condition of Jerusalem. He puts him in charge of Jerusalem along with this guy, Hananiah, who is the commander of the fortress. Presumably, Nehemiah, as the governor of Jerusalem, or the governor of Judah, has duties that sometimes take him away from Jerusalem. That could be part of why he is entrusting Hanani, his brother, with this job. Or he was cognizant that he had told Artaxerxes that he would only be gone for a certain amount of time. So he wanted somebody who could be in the position on a longer term than he himself could be. And basically what he tells them is, you know, we need to stay vigilant here. Don't open the gates until it's hot. And everyone needs to stand guard in front of their own house. And then it notes that there were not a lot of people living in the city. So what we're going to see in the next section is Nehemiah is going to pull out the list of returnees from Ezra 2. We're going to talk about that in a minute. But we need to keep in mind that the goal of what he's doing is he's going to get all these people together so he can fill up Jerusalem with inhabitants. That's going to be delayed until chapters 11 and 12. In the meantime, we're going to have more stories about Israel's unfaithfulness and about repentance that they take. Repentance. Do you take on repentance? A situation that the Israelites repent of. But remember that one of Nehemiah's projects is to fill up Jerusalem with people from each of the families represented in the genealogy that we'll look at in a second. But he's going to sort of interrupt himself to tell a story about all of the people, and then he's going to get back to finishing up the project of filling the city with people. So just keep that in sort of in the back of your mind. He says that he's going to do that, and he will do that. It's just going to take a couple more chapters than you might expect. Okay, so he has this plan to get everybody who's enrolled in the genealogies. And then he says this, then I found the book of the genealogy of those who came up first, in which I found the following record. So he's quoting from the text. These are the people of the province who came up from the captivity of the exiles whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away, and who returned to Jerusalem and Judah, each to his city, who came with Zerubbabel, Jeshua, Nehemiah, Azariah, Ramiah, Nahamani, Mordecai, Bilshan, Mispereth, Bigvai, Nehum, Bana. Okay, so there's 12 people in this group. In Nehemiah's version of this, just this introductory material who came with, Nahamani is listed, but Nahamani is not listed in Ezra's list. So there's a slight deviation there. I said last time when we talked about this sort of introductory matter in Ezra 2 that Mordecai is probably not Esther's cousin that we know from the book of Esther. It's a different Nehemiah. It's probably a different Ezra. You know, all of these names we see in multiple places in the Bible, but they're not sort of other people listed elsewhere. Zerubbabel, of course, we remember is the Davidic heir, and Jeshua is the high priestly heir. So aside from a couple of small differences, which I'm going to talk about momentarily, the list in Ezra 2 and Nehemiah 7 are virtually identical. So I have created a spreadsheet that takes us through these numbers. And now, as I have been punting for weeks on talking about Ezra 2 and Nehemiah 7, I'm going to finally address this section. Okay, so if you have this handout, I have a column that says group, and that just lists the different people which are listed as the different groups that came back to Israel from the captivity. In the second column, it's not labeled, but it is variations on what the group is that Nehemiah has that Ezra does not have. So if Nehemiah lists somebody and they have different statistics or have a different name altogether than what Ezra has, that's what that second column does. I have a column that has the totals from Ezra 2. I have a column that has the totals from Nehemiah 7. And then I have a column of notes for Ezra. I have a column of notes for Nehemiah. And then I have a column that says D, which is divorces. And so what I have done is I have put the number of people from each group that were represented among the divorces. In the divorces, they don't, from Ezra 9, I believe, or Ezra 10, it doesn't list numbers, it just names the people. So I counted the names up and put them in that column. So I will comment on that in a second. So if we look at this table, we will see that there are a couple of different breakdowns of the people. So if we look at right under the people of Israel, we will see that the first group listed are the descendants of Parosh. So in Ezra 2 and Nehemiah 7, both of them list the descendants of Parosh as, or Parosh, however you say it, as 2,172 people. So because it lists both of them the same, I have listed that number centered between the columns so you see that they're the same. This is true of the descendants of Shephatiah, of Elam, of Zakai, the Atur of Hezekiah, of the sons of Kiriatharim, etc., etc. You can sort of look at this list at your pleasure. Then you'll see the first instance of this is the descendants of Arah, that Ezra has 775 people listed, but Nehemiah has 652. So I've organized the table to show discrepancies, even if they're small discrepancies of even one number, just so you can compare. Now, if we return our attention to this column that says the people of Israel, I have elided, I have left out a bunch of verbiage and have just used some shortcuts to try to represent that. So we have the descendants of Parosh, and then the next thing it says is of Shephatiah. I have left out the of. It is the descendant, presumably it's the descendants of Shephatiah. And then we go down the line and we have of Arah, of Pahath Moab. Now Pahath Moab in Ezra and Nehemiah says of the sons of Jeshua and Joab. So there is an extra little aside in the text. I have included that in the columns under Ezra and Nehemiah. When Nehemiah says basically the same as Ezra, I have put two quotation marks under it, the way that I would copy things when I was taking notes in history class. And so you can see when there are those sorts of interjections in the text. Now, there are a couple of places where there are very long lists. So if you go down a considerable ways to where it, under the Levites, it says the sons of the gatekeepers, you will see in the notes section under Ezra that it says one and there's a star. So that's sort of acting as a footnote. So if you go down to the bottom of the document, you will see that there is an extended interjection that says the sons of Shalum, Ater, Talmon, Akub, Hatida, and Shobai. I'm not going to read the other ones, don't worry. But basically that's to show you that the text, when you get these footnotes, as it were, you get this fairly significant chunk of text explaining who all of the people who fit into that category were. So the unverified sons of Israel, it tells you that they came up from Tel Mela, Tel Harsha, Cherub, Adon, and Immer, etc., etc. Okay, so unfortunately, as I was researching this, there is not a lot to say about the significance or the precedence of these people elsewhere in the Bible. A lot of these names only appear in Ezra, Nehemiah. Obviously, you have places. Oh, let me say that. So, the descendants of Parash starts a list that has a bunch of people who are presumably descendants of the people listed. And that goes all the way down to Gibbar, if you're looking at Ezra, or Gibeon, if you're looking at Nehemiah. Now, before I talk about the men of Bethlehem, let me note something about the final four names in both lists. So you'll notice that Bezai is Bezai, but I've put a little 2 next to Bezai in the Nehemiah column. That's to note that Bezai is listed second in Nehemiah's ordering, and that Hashum, because he has a little 1 next to his name, is listed first. So in Ezra's ordering, Hashum is third, but in Nehemiah's ordering, Hashum is first. Then we have this guy named Harif, who does not appear in Ezra's list, and we have this guy Gibeon, who does not appear on Ezra's list. Commentators are not helpful and don't spell things out for me in this regard. However, if you look at Jorah's numbers, he has 112 descendants. And if you look at Harif's numbers, he has 112 descendants. So it would not surprise me if Jorah and Harif are the same guy. None of the commentators will talk enough about it to let me know whether that's the case or not. Most commentaries, when you come to this section, they're like, they're virtually identical, except that a lot of the numbers don't match up, which is a super helpful thing for people to say. I will say a couple more things that other commentators say that are more sort of big picture, but in terms of commenting name by name, there's not a lot that goes on there. Some of these names we have found on in archaeological discoveries. They're on stamps or on tablets, so we can find that these were names that actually existed, but as to whether they were the same people, we don't know. Okay, so after the descendants of Parash and the whole litany of other people who are the descendants of the people listed, we have the men of Bethlehem. Now, we know that Bethlehem is a place, and Netophah and Anathoth. There's some discussion about whether Gibeon, which is immediately preceding Bethlehem in Nehemiah's list, is a place. And so this sort of this transitional figure between the men of Bethlehem and the men of Netophah. If there are, I believe in the text, it will have the men of Netophah, the men of Anathoth. And I have just inserted all the times where it switches from the men to the sons of Kiriath-Arim, of Raman Geba, the men of Michmas, etc., etc. So there are several main divisions. There are the people of Israel who are not descendants of Levi. And those people are all listed in this descendants of Parash, the men of Bethlehem, the sons of Kiriath-Yarim, etc., etc. We have the priests, we have the Levites, we have the temple servants, which in all the commentaries, they talk about the Nethinim. This is the name for the temple servants. There's some dispute about what that word means, and we're not exactly sure when these folks come into the picture. The text tells us that some of the temple servants, so two, if you look at the footnote in two, it will note more than halfway through, the sons of Solomon's servants. So they're included in the total, but there's a special division for the sons of Solomon's servants. There's some suggestion that these temple servants are war captives that are brought in to assist the Levites with working in the temple. They would presumably not do anything that, you know, a Gentile couldn't do, but they're auxiliary functions that would be helpful to Levites if Levites didn't have to do them, that the temple servants can do, that then frees up the Levites for their jobs. So we have the people of Israel, the priests, the Levites, the temple servants. We have unverified sons of Israel, that is people who come back who do not have a record of their genealogy. So let me just read the footnote for them. Those who came up from Tel Melah, Tel Harsha, Kerub, Adan, and Immer, but they were not able to give evidence of their father's household and their descendants, whether they were of Israel. And then it says the sons of Deliah, the sons of Tobiah, the sons of Nakoda. Okay, so we have these people who are not able to give evidence that they are part of the sons of Israel. And then we have unverified sons of the priests, which include Habiah, Hakoz, and Barzillai. Barzillai is special because it notes that he took a wife from the daughters of Barzillai, the Gileadite, and he was called by their name. So there's this guy, Barzillai, who, contrary to tradition, took on his wife's family's name. Anyway, these three groups of people searched among their ancestral registration, but they could not be located. Therefore, they were considered unclean and excluded from the priesthood. The governor said to them that they should not eat from the most holy things until a priest stood up with Urim and Thummim. Now, as I've pointed out on multiple occasions, our guy Merimoth, the son of Uriah, is one of the sons of Hakoz, and he is an acting priest in the time of Ezra. So presumably, by the time Ezra comes around, the Urim and Thummim has been restored so that you can have an acting priest from the sons of Hakoz. Then you have a total listed for the remnant of the people. And then you have a list of slaves, a list of singing men and women, a list of animals, and a list of people's contributions. I'm going to make a couple more observations about this list in general, and then I want to talk more big picture. I want to make some comments about some specifics about this list, and then I want to talk about some things that people say about this list in general. And then we should be done. Okay, so first thing to notice is that the total number of people, if you add up all of the people of Israel, you get different numbers because of the differences between Ezra and Nehemiah. However, the priests in both Ezra and Nehemiah, both in the total total number of each family, is exactly the same. So the sons of Jediah are 973 both places. Immer is 1052 both places. Pasher is 1247 both places. And Harim is 1017 both places. So the totals that you would get from adding both of those up end up being the same. The Levites, you end up having different numbers, although the sons of Jeshua and Kadmiel are the same. The temple servants are the same. We don't have any numbers for the unverified sons of the priests. But both Ezra and Nehemiah list the total number of people returning as 42,360 people. Now, if you do the math on the numbers that are actually listed, and I've done that for you in the column below, I have the total remnant actual sum. You will see that there is a difference between the sum that you get and that you're 12,500 short, give or take. So you have to account for all of those people if you're going to make sense of this list, if you're not just going to say that the list is an error. What I tried to do, even though the text says this was the total, aside from their slaves and singing men and women, is I tried to add the slaves and singing men and women to the total in the hope that the aside somehow in Hebrew could mean something different and that the people really did think of their slaves and singing men and women as part of their group. And so I have modified the sum. And so you can see that I have for Ezra 37,436, and you know, you're within 30 for Nehemiah, and that is much closer. Now you're only, you know, 5,000 short instead of 12,000 short, but the numbers still don't add up. Also, interestingly, the horses, mules, camels, and donkeys are exactly the same numbers. The contributions vary some, and I've in the notes on Nehemiah, I have added up how it puts that together. So there is the problem of what are these numbers doing, or how do these numbers end up working out in this section? And I'll talk about that in a second. I want to note a couple of things, a couple more specifics. You'll note that in the temple servants, I went through all of the names and figured out that in Ezra, we do not list Shalmai, and in Nehemiah, we do not list Akub, who is in Ezra. So there are a number of people missing. However, the numbers end up being exactly the same for both of them. So maybe Shalmai and Akub are the same person. And then the only other difference between the list is that Lod, Hadid, and Ono, and the men of Jericho are switched in Ezra and Nehemiah. Lod, Hadid, and Ono come first in Ezra, but they come second in Nehemiah. Okay, so what are we to make of these lists? There are several articles that I read talking about the significance of these numbers, and I was hopeful that in looking at this, that there might be some greater significance here, that including the Begats is not just a boring thing that people did in the ancient world. But unfortunately, I don't think that there is a lot more going on beyond the important work of sort of creating a census of the people. One scholar has suggested that we are to take the total and the real sum literally, that in fact, the what you get with the real sum should be taken as a correct number, and that we should also be taking the total as a correct number. And what the author of Ezra and Nehemiah is doing by having that difference between the two, that he was aware of this difference, is to recognize that while there may be, you know, 42,360 people coming back from Babylon, they are not true Israel, that only 29,899 people are true Israel. It's tricky to think of things in that way. For one thing, you would have to then have reasons for why the Ezra section is summed differently. Why do the numbers not match in Ezra? If the purpose is to have the sum be different from the total given, why then do Ezra and Nehemiah not concur on every number? So it's just more likely that there's been some kind of copying error in the transmission of the text, which is really unfortunate. it's unfortunate that we are in a state where this book that we believe to be so important, we don't have the autographs. Now, numbers are not, you know, ultimately important. I don't think that this shakes my confidence at all in the accuracy of what it's saying, but it's just unfortunate that the passing down of this document has been riddled with human error, just like everything else. I suppose that in some ways is reassuring because it means God is consistent, that people are fallible all the way through, but I don't know. I wish it were different. One of the commentators references a guy named H.L. Ulrich, who has apparently written a very substantive demonstration of how the numerals got confused in the Hebrew. In Hebrew, you use letters to signify numbers. They don't have a separate script for numbers the way that we do. They just use the letters of the alphabet. And apparently this guy, H.L. Ulrich, has done some work to show how in Ezra and Nehemiah, what the specific sort of issues were that sort of happened. That sounds totally fascinating, but unfortunately, because of my limited resources, I was not able to look at H.L. Ulrich's work. I did find the journal that he wrote this particular article for, and it was like, here's the first page. If you would like to read the rest, it's behind a paywall. So I was not able to sort of verify what he's saying. Now, David has said for a long time that something like the confusion of how to read the numerals has probably been the culprit for why big numbers end up being very strange in the Old Testament. And apparently this H.L. Ulrich guy has done some work in speaking to that. Okay, as I said, in chapters 11 and 12, we're going to get an account of people moving to Jerusalem, but we're going to get an interruption to get less of an administrative story that we've gotten in, particularly in this last little section with the genealogy lists and the census list. And we're going to get more sort of a human story. Ezra's going to come back into the story, and we're going to have some sin revealed of the people, and we're going to get some repentance. That's all that I have to say about this section today. That's all I have to say about Ezra 2 and Nehemiah 7. So hopefully you're not too disappointed. Next week, we're going to get into some real substantive. This is analogous to the section of Ezra where Ezra has his prayer in Ezra 9. So we're going to get more into that sort of flavor vein of thing. So hopefully it will be a little more interesting or edifying than the census and administrative stuff was this week. All right. Thank you guys for your attention, and we'll see you next week.